With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom? Let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send her a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you wish to ask. And then she can either type a response or use their voice-to-text feature, and MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and stories for eternity. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy. It's something that you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. And this is something that Ethan and I had been thinking about doing with our parents. We have this podcasting equipment, so we wanted to find a way for them to tell their story. But I love this because it's so regimented. They send them a question every week, and it just makes it really easy and turnkey. And it just seems like a great way for us to get our parents' stories down so that our children and our children's children can have them. So if you're interested, check out MyLifeInABook.com and use code ATTWG at checkout for 15% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use code ATTWG for 15% off today. Are you ready to lose weight? With Effecty, getting access to powerful GLP-1 weight loss medications has never been easier or more affordable. Effecty offers compounded semaglutide, the same active ingredients as the popular name brands, but for up to 80% less. These medications work by regulating appetite and blood sugar, helping you lose weight in a sustainable, science-backed way. Getting started is so simple. Just fill out a short medical questionnaire, then connect with a licensed provider through a quick chat-based telehealth consultation. If you're eligible, your prescription gets shipped straight to your door. No hassle, no waiting rooms. With transparent pricing, no hidden fees, and no membership required, Effecty is committed to making proven weight loss treatments accessible to everyone. Effecty gave me the opportunity to try their service out, and I have to say, it is just as easy as they say it is. I filled out the questionnaire, and within days, a package arrived at my door filled with everything I needed and detailed instructions. Their website also tells you everything you need to know, and you can always chat with your healthcare provider. It really is that simple and convenient. So if you're ready to level up your weight loss game, my listeners can now get $50 off of GLP-1 weight loss treatments at Effecty.com with code ATTWG at checkout. That's Effecty.com, EFFECTY.com, and use the code ATTWG to get $50 off your first month of GLP-1 weight loss treatment. No hassles, no memberships, and no hidden fees. So get started today. Has it ever felt like you're doing everything right? You're eating healthy, you're working out, and yet your energy still crashes, or your mood swings hit out of nowhere, like a twist in a crime story that you didn't see coming. Listen, I've been there too, and what I've discovered is that many of these issues could be tied to hormonal imbalances, like a hidden criminal lurking in the background, throwing everything off track. But here's the good news. This is one mystery that you can solve with Happy Mammoth. There's no need for a long investigation. Just take the free 2-minute quiz from Happy Mammoth. You answer a few questions about what you're experiencing and where you're at in life, and you'll uncover the real culprit behind your hormonal symptoms. And the best part? After taking the quiz, you'll get a personalized recommendation to help you balance your hormones so you can finally feel like yourself again. According to a survey, after taking Hormone Harmony, 86% of women started to lose weight. 77% said that it improved their mood. And the biggest benefit? 100% of women surveyed said they're feeling like themselves again. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code ATTWG at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code ATTWG for 15% off today. On July 27th, 2021, 5-year-old Michael Vaughn's father went to go check on Michael's younger sister and order a pizza. He was out of the room for 15 or 20 minutes, but when he came back, his little boy was gone. Police in Fruitland, Idaho, along with other agencies, launched a massive search, but no trace of the boy was found. Nearly a year and a half went by until seemingly out of nowhere, an arrest was made. Who was arrested, and what does this person have to say about what happened to Michael Vaughn? When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to update you on the story of Michael Vaughn. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Everyone.
Welcome back.
So there has been huge news this week in the case of Michael Vaughn, which we covered back in December of 2021. And it was a very new case at that point. I mean, not even 6 months old. And usually we don't cover cases that recent because, as we talk about many, many times in this podcast, 99% of missing people are found, you know, fairly quickly. And so, you know, for a case to be quote unquote unsolved, you have to wait a while just by the nature of it.
Right.
But this one struck me and it just seemed to be the kind of situation that wasn't going to be resolved easily. And so that's why I thought it was important to, you know, at least quickly cover it in a bonus episode.
I don't remember it being a bonus episode. That's interesting.
Yeah, it was because we were on, it was in December and we were taking a break between seasons.
Oh.
Yeah, but I've been seeing so much about him online that I just really wanted to tell his story. And so we did. We came back for a little bonus episode.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was super impactful.
Yeah.
At least to me, to us.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And what's been really hard about this is that the investigation has been going on. But, you know, that's not to say it doesn't have any faults, right? Because we talk even in that episode about how the timeline of events has always been squishy. And, like, the cops haven't really released, I feel, as much information as they could in order to have people help as much as they could. Because Fruitland police have been asking for the public's assistance since the beginning, but they're just not giving enough information to work with. And I'll kind of talk about this a little bit more at the end, but what has happened, what I've seen, because I'm, you know, immersed in the online, like, missing person true crime community, is I've seen the lack of information coupled with, you know, the family and the police asking for help kind of melding together into this situation where people have been going rogue, you know, so people have been doing their own real life investigations. Like, they have been driving to this neighborhood. They have been questioning neighbors. They have been, like, standing in front of houses and screaming. Like, they have been saying shit online. They have been accusing people of different things. Like, it has been intense over the past year and a half.
And you think that has to do with the lack of a hard timeline being released by the police?
Yeah, I do think that that's a contributing factor for sure, because when you have people online who, you know, genuinely, like, in their heart, like, they start from a good place, right? Like, they want to help. They want to find a child. And when you don't have actual facts, you kind of start to fill them in yourselves. And people have been doing that and then coming up with these theories and then coming up with, like, oh, well, this is suspicious, that is suspicious. And it's been a lot. I mean, I don't even know how to explain it to somebody like you who is not involved in this and who does not see this online every day.
Yeah, right. I'm what some people would call normal.
Yeah, I know. I know. Yeah. But yeah, it's been so much. And this arrest that happened this week flies in the face of what a lot of people have been theorizing and, you know, about online and kind of making accusations about. But again, we don't need to get into all that. I'll talk a little bit more about that in the end. I just, you know, it is just one of those things that the rest, I mean, is one of those things that seemingly came out of nowhere. So on November 11th, 2022, the first arrest was made in this case. And I say first because it is pretty clear based on what Fruitland police have said since then that there are more people involved. And this is not the happy ending that we were all hoping for, of course, because Fruitland Police Chief J.D. Huff has publicly stated that they are looking for remains currently.
Right.
But I'm happy that Michael's family has at least more of a chance to get some answers than they did a week ago. And so I've been talking about all of this all week on TikTok. So, you know, make sure you're following us there if you want to see the real time, like, unhinged videos that I've been posting. And if you are coming here from TikTok, this is actually what we usually do, which is we kind of gather and I research and we put everything together into one coherent place instead of like a million 60 second videos. So this episode is going to be what we've learned in the past week, but this is by no means the end of the story. There's so much more that's going to be happening in this, and we will continue to follow up with this until we have some sort of a resolution. But the purpose of this episode is to gather all the thoughts that I've been putting out in these videos into one, like, hopefully more coherent place. And like we usually do when we have updates on cases, I'll also put the original episode at the end of this so that you can get more context as to all of the circumstances behind Michael's disappearance. So we're going to have the update first. And then if you want more context, you can listen after the credits to the original episode. So anyway, with that extremely longer than usual preamble behind us, let's get to the updates in the Michael Vaughn case. Michael Joseph Vaughn is one of four children belonging to Brandy Neal and Tyler Vaughn. He has an older brother and sister, as well as a younger sister. The family lives in Fruitland, Idaho, which is a small town in southwest Idaho. It's about 50 miles from Boise, and it borders Oregon. And that's helpful to know because a lot of my research led to Oregon. And I had forgotten because it had been, you know, almost a year since we did our first episode on this, that Fruitland and, like, was basically on the border of Oregon. And I just kept on seeing all these references to Oregon. I'm like, well, that seems weird. Like, what a coincidence. But I just don't know geography, as it turns out. It's really all that is. A lot of people in this area kind of bounce back and forth between the states. One of the frustrations with this case is that, like I said, the exact timeline has been hard to nail down. But the best we figured is between 6:30 and 7 p.m., Tyler went to go check on Aria, the baby, and order a pizza. When he returned to the living room where Michael was playing video games, like I said, about 15 to 20 minutes later, Michael was gone. he, you know, went out and looked for him, couldn't find him, and then immediately called Brandy at work to tell her that Michael had seemingly disappeared. He couldn't find him. By the time Brandy got home from work, neighbors were out searching and the police had arrived. So there was a very fast response to this, both from the neighbors and Fruitland police. Neighbors later said that they witnessed Michael knocking on doors right before his disappearance. One neighbor whose door he knocked on said that he was asking if her child could come out and play. So the child either wasn't there or the neighbor told Michael to go ask his parents first. Either way, she watched Michael until he got to his yard and then she went back inside. Then after that, though, another neighbor saw him running down the block, but she didn't think it was weird because he was heading toward like where some other kids were playing. So basically, he was just out looking for kids to play with. Now, when police arrived, they brought canines in immediately. According to Brandy, the dogs caught Michael's scent and tracked it to the end of their street away from the farm field to the right of the house and then stopped abruptly. The FBI and other agencies were called in and the search continued.
Right. So the canine losing the scent abruptly indicates that there was a car involved.
Right. Right.
Like that's the only way that, a scent breaks so abruptly.
Typically. Yeah.
Usually.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We talked about this in the original episode. Fruitland Police is a very small agency. I think there are like 11 cops there or something. So they very quickly called in the FBI, which is great. Despite this, there were scant clues, but there were a few vehicles and persons of interest that police released. And then, you know, one was this like white Honda Pilot, and that was a whole big thing. And that was something that went on until very recently. And it's only recently that police say like that Honda Pilot, which was a white 2010 to 2016 model that was seen about a block away, doesn't have any connection to the house that is in question now. There was also a few people who are caught on like Ring doorbell cameras and things like that, who police couldn't identify for a long time and who didn't come forward. There was one man who was on Southwest 8th Street, again, a block away from Michael's home, and he was wearing a white t-shirt and black shorts. He had dark hair. Now, this is the guy that police like apparently could not identify for months, although I did just read that they think they know who he is and that they don't think that he's involved. So why he didn't come forward, I don't know, but it seems as though maybe he was a red herring along with the Honda Pilot. So those were just a few, though, of the tips that came in. Those were like the most actionable ones that they got. But early on, police received like over 500 tips. I mean, very quickly. But they really didn't seem to lead anywhere. And, you know, we did the case in December of 2021. And basically all this year, like there really have not been any more updates. And so that's why I was really surprised to hear on November 13th that Fruitland Police announced an arrest. Chief J.D. Huff said that based on what he called, quote, a very credible tip, end quote, Fruitland Police executed a search warrant at 1102 Red Wing Street on November 11th. This led to the arrest of one of the home's occupants, 35-year-old Sarah Wandra. Sarah lives in the home with her husband, Stacy, but Stacy is currently in jail in Washington County, Idaho, on unrelated charges. On Friday, the 11th, Sarah was charged with failure to report a death.
So how did they get to the conclusion that she failed to report a death? Because you said at the beginning that they hadn't found anything yet.
Right. And at the time of this recording, they still haven't. So as of this moment, Michael has not been found. So I and a lot of other people, you know, did find it very interesting that they were confident enough
to announce that.
Yeah.
That they were charging her.
Yeah,
with that
particular charge, right? Because, right. You know, if it were just an instance that we've seen before in other cases of them trying to find something to charge her with to hold her so that they could try to get more information, I feel like there are probably other charges that they could have come up with that weren't failure to report a death. Because to me, you have to have something to back that up, right?
Yeah.
And when you don't have a body, you have to have something else that's pretty good, one would think. So we don't know exactly what that is. But, you know, it goes back to J.D. Huff saying it was a very credible tip. So we can only infer what that tip must have been at this point. So the next day, the 12th, Saturday, police began digging in the backyard where Sarah and Stacy lived with a backhoe in hopes of finding the missing little boy. Now, this is not a large yard. You know, we're not talking multiple acres or anything like that. We're talking like, you know, a decent sized yard.
But like a standard suburban,
single family home.
Single family,
I mean, it
house.
Looks similar to like our yard. I mean, it's just a yard, you know?
Right.
Despite that, Chief Huff warned the public that this was not going to be a quick process, saying, quote, "It's going to take us a while to get this done, but we're not going to stop. We're pretty confident in the information we received," end quote.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So that really makes me wonder what the source of the information was.
That's what everybody's wondering, right? Because the other thing that Chief Huff said initially in that like first press conference was that the occupants of the house, who we know now to be Sarah and Stacy, were renters and that they didn't believe that the owners were involved.
Okay.
And that is going to be extremely interesting as we go on. So the dig started Saturday and continued in the days that followed. Huff told reporters that dirt removed from the backyard is being taken to another location for processing. He also confirmed that cadaver dogs are brought in. Like I said, as of this recording, the digs are still happening and are expected to possibly continue for another week.
And did he say anything about cadaver dogs hitting on anything?
No. You know, somebody had asked me on TikTok, they're like, what are they doing? Are they like literally sifting through every scoopful of dirt? And
yes,
like, yeah, that actually does seem pretty much like what they're doing.
Yeah.
Because
I mean, they're literally looking for any human remains.
Right.
Look, a backhoe is a big machine. Yes, it digs dirt up quickly, but it can also disturb remains. But, you know, they're looking for any kind of evidence of a body being in that backyard.
Right. And if you listen to our coverage or of the Kristen Smart case, or if you listen to the Your Own Backyard podcast, there are a lot of indicators of a body being buried somewhere that go beyond human remains.
Right.
And so I think they are looking into all of that very carefully. So at the top of everybody's list of questions, of which there are a million, has to be, who is Sarah Wandra?
Right.
Like, who is this lady who they think knows about Michael's death? We immediately found out that she is not somebody who Michael's family knows. So despite, you know, her house being like 4 minutes away is what the news reports kept saying. I Google mapped it. It's about a half mile away. So it's like a 4 minute drive, but you know,
close, but not like a
direct neighbor,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. So it totally makes sense that they wouldn't know each other, but very much in the area. And same with their husband, Stacy, like they don't know him either. They do not know these people. The thing that's so upsetting, I mean, I shouldn't say the thing as if there's only one, there are many things that are so upsetting about this entire situation. But if this tip proves to be accurate, then that means that Michael never left the area, that he has been within a half a mile of his home this entire time. Now, keep in mind that Sarah Wandra hasn't been charged with physically harming Michael, at least not yet. Right now, they're only saying that she knows what happened to him. Now, there was some information that was reported on that came from the probable cause affidavit, but that has since been sealed by the judge, the affidavit has. So even though I read some of the information, I wasn't able to get a hold of the documents themselves, but there are a few Idaho newspapers who reported on it before it was sealed. So I was able to read some quotes from the affidavit that were very illuminating. But again, since it has been sealed, I don't want to get into the specifics of it. But what I will say is that her statements on the day of her arrest make it seem like Fruitland police are indeed on the right track. So knowing that the answers to Michael's disappearance could very well be in his neighborhood, it's important to talk about the area. Now, one of the first things that both police and the public keyed in on during like the initial investigation, we're talking days after his disappearance, is the large number of registered sex offenders near Michael's home. Just to put this in perspective, I put in our address to search for registered sex offenders.
Do I want to hear this?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think it might make you feel okay. Not great. But if you put in our address, there are 7 offenders who pop up nearby. When you put in Michael's address, there are 64.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Right. So it's a lot. And to be fair, because they are so close to Oregon, I think part of some of those people are in Oregon, but you know, I don't think like the state borders necessarily matter.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, 64. And like, listen, we don't live in a gated community or anything like that. I mean, it's not like there are so fewer sex offenders here because we live in like some crazy.
No, we live on a main thoroughfare of our town.
Yeah. So because everybody was aware of this large number of registered sex offenders, that was, of course, one of the first things that the police investigated. So, you know, they interviewed registered sex offenders early on. Like, that was very much a part of the investigation. But despite recent speculation that I have been seeing online since the arrest, neither Sarah nor her husband, Stacy, are on that list. They do, however, have extensive criminal records, but not for anything involving sexual assault of a minor or otherwise. In fact, their crimes are mostly nonviolent, like theft, mail fraud, identity theft, things like that. I mean, it's more like financial than anything else. I was looking at, you know, one of their social media accounts, and there was like an old business partner who was accusing them of stealing from him. You know, it's like it's stuff like that. So Sarah and Stacy were married on April 13th, 2018. I mentioned Sarah's 35. Stacy's currently 30. They bounced back and forth between Fruitland and Oregon, and they got arrested in both places. At one point, Stacy actually had a fugitive warrant out for him, like from Oregon. Like when they came back to Fruitland, he was an Oregon like fugitive. Both of them have a large presence on social media that has not been locked down by authorities yet. So it's still there.
Especially, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is. Especially Sarah. Like she was very like literally posting multiple times a day, like that type. And if you take like a basic look at their social media, you see a lot of pictures of them together, a lot of pictures of them in bed together, kissing and, you know, very a lot of whatever, like very together. But It does seem as though their marriage was initially rocky because court records show that Sarah filed for divorce in 2019, just before their 1-year anniversary. But it does seem as though this was abandoned because it seems as though like Stacy didn't respond and then it said it was vacated. I don't know. Like it just didn't seem like it actually went through. And by October of that year, they were seemingly back in love and doing crimes. Stacy was arrested in Oregon for several counts of theft and writing a bad check. Sarah was arrested that same day for multiple counts of theft, as well as theft or receipt of stolen mail and identity theft. On April 13th, 2022, their fourth anniversary, the couple was arrested again.
Happy anniversary.
I know. I don't remember what we did for our fourth anniversary, but I mean, nothing that exciting. I can tell you that. They were both charged with unlawful possession of a gun by a felon. So by this point, they both had felony records. But again, they were just...
Right. It's not violent felonies, but they're still felonies.
Exactly. So his was from writing bad checks. Hers was from like identity theft or something. I don't know exactly which one was the felony. Maybe probably the mail fraud.
Yeah. But felony plus firearms should be 5 years.
Well, yeah. So we'll get to that. So that's what they were arrested for.
That's what they were originally charged with.
Yes.
Okay.
So on April 13th of this year, Stacy was only charged with that. Sarah was charged with that and aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, destruction of evidence, battery, and possession of a controlled substance.
Okay.
And all of this was very confusing to me because law enforcement records aren't great.
No, they are not.
Especially when you're skipping around jurisdictions. So it was very confusing to me because they were both arrested on these charges in April. And I had heard before I started looking into this that Stacy was currently in jail. And then I saw this arrest. I was like, oh, in April. Like, okay. And then I'm going through, because they were arrested in Payette County, which is the county that Fruitland is in. So I'm like looking through the Payette County records. It has all of like the hearings, right? So it's like the plea, the evidentiary hearing, the preliminary hearing, do-do-do-do-do. And then it's like May 17th, case dismissed. And then the same thing for Sarah. And it's like all of these charges. And then it says case dismissed. And I said, that's weird.
Case dismissed.
Right. And I was like, that's crazy. And so when you can see it in one of my videos and I'm like, well, yeah, I don't know. I kept on hearing that he's in jail, but according to this, like his case was dismissed in May. So I don't know. But what I have learned from another helpful TikTok watcher is that he is currently being held in Washington County, Idaho. And I don't know why specifically Washington County, but it sounds like he is being held there on the federal gun charges. So I don't know if this makes sense. Like, you tell me, like, is it a thing to be held in a county jail for a federal crime when you're awaiting trial? Because he got transferred there. So that's the thing. Like, those charges were dismissed in Payette County because the county is like, this is not our deal, is what it sounds like. This is, we're just kicking it over to the feds. And then Stacy has been in Washington County ever since, awaiting his trial on these federal gun charges.
That's not actually that surprising, especially considering this seems like not a rural area, but not a big city.
Yeah.
So the thing about the feds is that, you know, they don't have housing facilities for federal violators awaiting trial.
Okay. So there are no like federal jails that you sit in when you're
No, once the only, no, no. So it's, they obviously use local jails to hold until trial. And then, yes, there are federal
prisons. Obviously.
Yes.
Yeah.
But there's no like just weird random pop-up federal jails where they're just going to hold
like the Harry Potter experience.
Yeah.
Just like a pop-up, like
that's not really a thing.
Yeah. Okay. We'll see. And I don't know. And
so, like in DC, anybody that's arrested on a federal level,
yeah,
in DC goes to the central cell block of DC.
Oh, okay.
So it's DC Department of Corrections that's housing them. But then the U.S. Marshals will go pick up the federal prisoners and take them to court.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes more sense. I unfortunately did not do the research into like the size of Payette County versus the size of Washington County. But if we're thinking that Washington County is like bigger, has more capacity, whatever.
Yeah, that would probably make sense.
Then that's why he's being held there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it does seem like that's why the charges were dismissed in Payette, because they're just kicking him over to the feds, like I said. What's interesting is that he's in jail, but Sarah is not, and she had many more charges against her.
Right. But if they're exclusively turning this over to a federal case, the feds are probably going to drop the charges that wouldn't hold up in a federal prosecution.
Right. So like the battery charge or whatever.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. So that makes sense.
This is all getting very court technical.
I know.
Shit, but like that's the way the courts operate.
So my guess, and I don't know this for certain, is that Sarah's family bailed her out and Stacy did not get bailed out. And that's why he's in Washington. Because, and again, I didn't know what was going on with Sarah. Like, I just saw that charges were dismissed. But at her arraignment on Monday, the prosecutor mentioned how she is awaiting trial on federal gun charges. So she's awaiting trial just like Stacy is. But she was until last Friday out. And yeah, that is important for what, you know, I'm going to go into. All right. So we talked about who Sarah and Stacy Wander are, but how did this couple, who has no known connection to Michael and who mainly just tried to steal money from people for many years, get wrapped up in this whole mess? And, you know, this is, of course, where we have to start speculating, because we don't have any hard answers.
Right.
Chief Huff has publicly stated that the credible tip came from someone inside the house.
So his words were somebody inside the house.
Yes.
Somebody that lives inside the house, or because we're talking about owners versus renters also.
He made a point to say that the owners were not involved.
Not involved does not mean they were not the tipsters.
That's true. That's true. So I don't know, but he said inside the house. He didn't say associated with the house. You know, I feel like inside the house is a very specific thing to say.
It does lend itself to being somebody that lives.
Right.
Inside
the house. He didn't use the word lives.
Right. Somebody inside the house.
Yeah.
Not lives inside the house.
Right. You know, if we're talking about inside the house to mean people who live inside the house, from what I've been able to find, despite there have been like some, there's been some talk about a roommate or whatever, I haven't been able to find any evidence of a roommate. From what I have been able to find, Sarah and Stacy are the only people who currently live in that home.
At least legally.
Right. But I was talking about another case with somebody like yesterday, and typically, even if they're not quote unquote legally living there, meaning they're not on the lease or, you know, whatever, if they receive mail at that address, then it does show up on a background report as like a known location. And the only two people that I could find for that address at this time were Sarah and Stacy. And that's not 100% infallible for sure, but it's what we got. So anyway, Sarah seemed caught off guard when police showed up at her home on Friday. And it does not at all seem like this tip came from her. Like, she did not seem to know why they were there at first. She obviously quickly figured it out, but it doesn't seem like, oh, I called you, now you're here. Like, okay. If we are talking about somebody who lives in the house, the only person logically who is left is Stacy. He's been sitting in jail for months. He's facing federal gun charges. Could he have had a crisis of conscience?
Or is this a jailhouse snitch?
Well, maybe not so much a jailhouse snitch, because jailhouse snitches generally don't like snitch on themselves, but he could be trying to make a deal of some sort. And if you look at the couple's behavior on social media, a lot of it could, in fact, seem like a crisis of conscience. Sarah's TikTok account went dormant in 2020, but she came back in September of 2021 with almost exclusively religious content. There are a lot of Bible passages and talk about how Jesus loves everyone, but there's also talk about the rapture and how Jesus is coming back soon. So here's a clip from one video just to give you an idea of the general tone of these.
So, I don't know if I'm the only Christian that's noticed this lately, but since all this chaos started happening, I just noticed a lot of people seem to be pushing their witchcraft on here. And I'm not saying that people can't believe what they want to, because that's totally up to them. But as a fellow believer, I'm just trying to warn my fellow Christians or anybody that is seeking God, that's no good. That is straight talking to the devil and letting him talk to you. Don't forget, the Bible says that the devil disguises himself as an angel of light. So just because it looks good doesn't mean the brownies are on point. Sometimes they're burnt and you don't even know it till you eat one. You know what I mean?
So that was Sarah Wandra.
Okay.
It's a lot of that, but then also Bible verses and also the rapture.
I mean, she sounds like a loon, but I don't get any indication of kidnapping and murdering a child.
No. And that's what's so confounding about this, is they both seem a little off, but not in a way that you're like, oh, yes, now it makes sense. However, there has been some more disturbing behavior since July 27th, 2021, when Michael went missing. Stacy's posts also had a religious slant to them, but not to the extent of Sarah's. His posts, to me, though, were even more disturbing. On July 28th, the day after Michael went missing, he posted about Michael's disappearance on Facebook.
Okay.
And on its face, on July 28th, nobody thought that was a red flag because, again, he lived like in the neighborhood, right? It's normal to post on Facebook about a missing kid in your neighborhood. So this is all of this. It's like only upsetting in hindsight. So he posted about Michael the day after his disappearance and then temporarily changed his profile picture to Michael's photo, which does seem a bit stranger to me.
I mean, yes, but again, we're looking, like you said,
in hindsight,
at things, right, through hindsight. So
he made Michael's photo his profile picture, like days afterwards. And it was just his picture. It wasn't his missing poster. It wasn't anything like that. To the point where one of the comments on it was just from some, like, you know, random person who was like, oh, is that you? You know, like when you were a little kid. And he was like, no, this is like a kid who's missing in my neighborhood. And they're like, oh, okay. Like, that is a little odd. I think that's a little odd at the time, not just in hindsight. Sarah also started posting about Michael a few days after that, like the beginning of August, August 2nd, I want to say, is the first post. And they both continued to like comment on posts and things like that. But what was the most upsetting to me is that after the arrest, when we found out who was arrested and I was looking into her and I found her TikTok account, I just, you know, randomly like clicked on a few videos. And the very first video that I clicked on, you can see her fridge in the background and she has Michael's missing poster hanging on her fridge. And it's blurry and it's small and it's like you can barely see it. But like, again, I've been staring at these fucking posters for a year and a half. And I knew immediately, like, oh, like that's the poster, because there are several versions, right? I'm like, oh, that's the poster that has his picture. And then it has a separate picture of the Minecraft t-shirt he was wearing when he went missing. And I pulled it up and I reversed it because like TikTok videos, you know, it reverses it and it's the same fucking poster. And I think more than the social media stuff, seeing that was really upsetting. His little face has been looking at them every time they went into the fridge to get milk. And we don't have the answers yet, and we don't know what happened. But after a year and a half of basically nothing, the police felt confident enough to arrest this woman. And all I can think about is Michael's mother and family knowing that this woman is sitting in jail for concealing the death of their son. And his little face was on her fridge the entire time. And obviously, like, I've known about that all week, and like, it really, and I've talked about it, and I've watched the video several times, and I just didn't really hit me until just now how truly awful that is.
Why do you think they would have that there?
I don't know.
If we are to presume that they or one of them took Michael, did something terrible, why would they put his missing poster up on their fridge?
Guilt, maybe. I don't know. You know, I'm not a religious person, and I don't know if there's like some sort of penance, some sort of something involved in having to look at him every day.
This is like self-flagellation.
I don't know. I mean, you know, we're just so speculating right now. I have no idea. I don't know, but it's not uncommon for perpetrators to like involve themselves in the crime and, you know, keep close tabs on the crime and things like that. Right. And so I think a lot of the Facebook posts and things like that could be explained in that way. But yeah, the poster is just on another level, I feel like. And I don't know. I don't know the answer. But so getting back to like all of what we know now, right? The creepy posts, like their criminal history, the proximity to Michael's house, like there still seems to be a major missing piece, if not several major missing pieces, right?
Yeah.
Like it's still not coming together. It's still not making sense.
Correct. Yeah. This is not a crime that this couple, it's not their MO.
Exactly. It doesn't, it's just not something you're like, oh yes, of course it's them. Like, no, of course, like not at all. Right.
Now, of course, not, you know, nothing about any of these cases like this
makes sense. Makes any sense. Right.
But this one is like real left field because there's no indication of pedophilia. There's no indication of any real physical harm.
No, not that I know of, at least not
as far as their arrest records go.
Exactly, that I've been able to find, because again, when you switch jurisdictions, it's so hard. However, Sarah did talk in a TikTok post about how she was sexually molested as a child, but, you know, that's it. Like, beyond being a victim.
Right, but that does, like, how does that jump to
abducting and
abducting a child?
It doesn't, right? Like, that's not an A to B line.
No,
at all.
Definitely not.
Like, but that is the only kind of connection, right? Like, that's more of a connection than mail fraud.
Yeah, for sure.
But it seems as though if we're talking about Michael being in the neighborhood, then we need to talk about the neighborhood. Sarah and Stacy have only had intermittent employment. I mentioned, you know, like a previous like business partner of Stacy's was accusing them of stealing. So in Oregon, they had like an auto body or auto mechanic kind of place. So I guess like that's what Stacy does. He's a mechanic. And so they had a business in Oregon. And I don't know if that's the guy who was like accusing them. I didn't look that deeply into it, but that's what they were doing in Oregon. Now, in Idaho, they had been running some sort of a taxi service. Like, I don't know, like some just like weird taxi service. Like, that's what she's been doing. And then also on her Facebook, she said something about a laundry service that she had just launched. I don't know much about that. The taxi service seems to be like the main thing. So it seems as though like the couple is largely supported by Sarah's family. At her arraignment on Monday, Sarah said that her only asset is her car, which she co-owns with her father. Her father also owns the house on Red Wing Street where she and Stacy live. So they're the owners.
Oh, interesting.
I thought so. And then what's even more interesting is that I believe, but I'm not 100%, I believe it's her father and stepmother who own the house, but they also live in the neighborhood on a different street.
Hmm.
So that's interesting.
No, wait. Who did you say molested her as a child?
Her biological brother. And apparently her biological mother like knew about it or was involved somehow. That I'm not sure about. But I don't know. Somebody can correct me who like really did a deep dive into her videos, because I just simply could not. I don't believe like her father was involved in any of this.
Okay.
But she does refer to her as her biological mother. And I don't believe that's who the woman is who lives in the neighborhood now. But anyway, so her parents own the house that they live in on Red Wing Street. They live in the same neighborhood, in the same development, on a different street. But there's a third relative who I think may be her uncle, though I'm just kind of guessing on that, who lives directly across the street from her on Red Wing. So three houses in this neighborhood are owned by Sarah's family. So there's that. Then also interesting about this neighborhood is, you know, I talked about the 65 registered sex offenders. Three of them live together in the house next door to Sarah and Stacy. They share a fence.
What the fuck? Are you kidding me?
No, it's a family. It's the Starkey family. And three of them who have that as their address are registered sex offenders. And not only that, their charges are related to minors. Two men and a woman. So we need to take all of that into consideration. Keep that over on one side. And on the other side, take into consideration Chief Huff's statements. One time, he made a statement that said multiple people are involved, right? Like when they arrested Sarah, they said, you know, we think that multiple people know what happened to Michael, which makes sense if they're only charging her with concealing a death.
Right.
The other thing, and this is where we kind of get into more theories, is he said more recently, within the last day or so, that he believes that multiple people know about the abduction and murder of Michael Vaughn.
Oh.
So he was very clear in that language. Like, I'm sorry, like he's been doing this. I mean, he's been doing this for a while in general, but he's been on this case for a year and a half. You don't say abduction
and murder
without meaning it, you know?
Yeah.
And so that brings me to one of the big theories that has been going around. Because, of course, like the theory is, you know, Sarah and Stacy or the Starkeys or somebody else they were involved with kidnapped Michael, murdered him, they know about it, et cetera, right? The other theory, though, is that because they have this like taxi company, is that Sarah or Stacy or whomever accidentally hit Michael when he was out running around looking for friends, and it basically got out of hand. Like they covered it up. Like they took him. Maybe he passed away then. Maybe he passed away later. And they've just been hiding that ever since.
I mean, that's a convenient, easy, normal way to explain things. Sure. But didn't one of the witnesses originally say that there was a group of kids playing in the neighborhood?
Yes.
So if Michael had been hit by a car, don't you think somebody in the group of kids that were playing around there would have seen it and said something or screamed or whatever?
Yes. Thank you. That is exactly my point. And not even that, right? Like, even if nobody saw it because it's on like a side street or whatever,
they would have heard something.
Exactly. Because something like this just happened to us. And so at 2 a.m, like last week or something, somebody got into a single car accident, literally right in front of our house. They actually crashed their car and went onto our next door neighbor's lawn. This is at 2 a.m. You didn't wake up because you just will sleep through anything. I don't sleep, so I was already kind of awake and I heard it, but it was loud as shit. And I get it. If you're dead asleep, like whatever, you're not going to wake up. But when Michael went missing, it was the evening. It was like 6:30, 7 o'clock, whatever. And in at the end of July, it's still broad daylight. There are a million kids playing outside. There are people coming and going. There is not a chance in hell that a child could have been run over by a fucking car and nobody would notice.
Right.
Yeah. Right?
Not even, let's exclude the group of kids playing because...
Yeah, forget about that. Like, kids are dumb. But, like...
This is a suburban neighborhood.
Yeah.
Where houses are relatively close
together. No, they're close.
It's not like they're farmlands.
No, there is farmland near them. Sure, but there are... It's a lot of houses.
It's a neighborhood.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like if a car hits a child, even if the child doesn't make any noise, like there's going to be noise.
Yes.
The accident from the people that get out and start whatever.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, there's just no way. It's not like they were driving through the cornfield and then hit him. Like it. You know, it had to have been on a street with houses. And there's just no feasible way to me that that could have happened at that time of day and nobody would have noticed. Yeah. you know, especially in the past year and a half, nobody would have said, you know, I did hear something kind of weird. Like,
especially considering the outpouring of neighborhood support.
Exactly. Like, there's just no way. And so that's the common sense part of it, right? And then add that to Chief Huff's statement where he specifically said abduction and murder. Like, no, this was not just some accident that got out of hand.
So then the question is, what involvement do the sexual predator neighbors have with Stacy?
Well, so that's up in the air, right? Because, you know, you hear like some people are like, oh, they don't really know each other. And then you hear other people say, well, actually, they would like help out with the taxi business. Like, so I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. You know, I do kind of wonder if it's like slightly a red herring only because the sexual offender thing has been on the radar from the very beginning. But I mean, if the police are that confident, right. And so I should talk about the search a little bit. So, you know, they did slow down the search, even though it's not done. And they did say that they were kind of doing finer searches, meaning like not so much backhoe searches, but like smaller instrument searches, but then also focusing on the inside of the house too, see if there's anything they could find there. So like that is shifting in terms of whether or not they'll get probable cause to search the Starkey's property. We don't know at this point.
Yeah, I mean, that would be pretty tough unless you...
Yeah, you need more than just... Exactly. You need more than just like, you know, they're sex offenders. Like, that's not enough. Right? So... we don't know about that. That part's still up in the air. As I mentioned in the beginning of this episode, this is far from the end of the story. Brandy Neal, Michael's mother, was caught off guard by the news this weekend. She just like wasn't ready to get into the mindset of searching for remains. Like that is the word that got her, right? I mean, which you can understand as a parent. Like she wasn't ready to tell her kids that Michael probably wasn't coming back. Lauren Mathias, the family spokesperson, told reporters, quote, "She is not doing okay." That is a direct quote from her. "We are not okay. I've had to tell his siblings that he might not be coming home," end quote. In addition to having her child go missing, Brandy has spent the last year and a half getting bullied on the internet, which is what I was alluding to at the beginning. People judged every word she spoke and every tear she shed and then gleefully posted about it. Some of it, you know, was the same bullshit we always see, like she was crying too much, she wasn't crying enough, blah, blah, blah. But in Brandy's case, the judgment went far beyond that. I saw people outright accuse her and her family of not only lying about Michael's disappearance, but of being responsible for it themselves. And even today, like literally the morning that we're recording this, after the arrest, after everything, I saw two people standing by that on Twitter being like, yeah, no, they were lying. Like they haven't been telling the truth. We were just pointing that out. Like, whatever. As horrible as it must be to have to come to the realization that there's a good chance her son isn't coming home, my hope is that this arrest and this search will lead not only to answers, but to her and her family regaining some of their dignity and hopefully some measure of peace. Michael Joseph Vaughn has been missing from Fruitland, Idaho since July 27, 2021. He was 3'7" and 50 pounds at the time of his disappearance. He has blonde hair and blue eyes. Michael was last seen wearing a blue Minecraft t-shirt, blue boxer briefs, and flip-flops. He was 5 years old when he went missing. He would be 6 today. Anyone with any information is urged to contact the Fruitland Police Department at 208-642-6006, extension 0, or contact the department through its tip line at findmichael@fruitland.org. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
Thank you for tuning into this bonus episode. Stay tuned after this for our original episode of Michael Vaughn's disappearance. And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
On July 27th, 2021, 5-year-old Michael Vaughn was sitting in his living room in Fruitland, Idaho, playing video games. His father left him there to go check on Michael's younger sister and order a pizza. He was gone for maybe 15 or 20 minutes, but when he came back, his little boy was gone. Now, 4 months later, Michael, Monkey Vaughn, is still missing, and his parents are begging for police and the public not to let his case go cold. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. I want to tell you the story of Michael Vaughn. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Everyone,
welcome back.
Surprise.
I guess we're not taking a hiatus.
Yeah, I didn't tell Ethan about this either. Those of you who are regular listeners know that we are actually on a break. We are on a break and for the month of December. Why?
I'm supposed to be the one saying we were on a break.
I know, you should have appreciated that more. But I couldn't stay away. So this case is one that I've been following basically since the beginning, but I hadn't planned on doing an episode on it simply because it was so recent and there isn't a ton of public information out there, as is the case with, you know, generally with very recent cases. But Brandy Neal, who is Michael's mother, recently gave an interview to the Idaho Press where she basically just begged for more people to pay attention to her son's case. Like, they are really making a push for publicity right now. So I figured that, you know, we got to do it. Like, as much as we can help, you know, even with our audience, like, you know, we're not as big as some of the other major players in this space, but it was a good opportunity to just get his story out there, do what we can, and just do a little bonus mini-sode in between seasons.
Well, I mean, that is the point of the podcast, is getting more publicity out for missing persons. So
yeah,
I mean,
exactly. And when she's like literally said, like, people, please, like, do this case, like, please cover him. Like, I, you know, come on. You have to.
Also, his nickname is Monkey.
Yeah.
That's what we call Miller.
I know. And they look a lot alike, and he's almost exactly a year older than Miller. It's yeah, that's like part of the reason also I was kind of staying away from this a little bit, was just because it was very close to home.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's tough. But all right, so before we get started, we do have a few announcements to make since, you know, we haven't spoken to you all in a little bit. We finally have a merch store, which is exciting.
We still don't have any of our own merch.
Don't worry about it. It also doesn't have a good URL yet, but I put the link in the show notes so you can go and click on it there and check it out. We are also proud to announce that we are now members of the Darkcast Podcast Network.
Yay.
Yeah. We're joining other indie podcasts, including Reverie True Crime, The Jury Room, Brew Crime Podcast, and more. So that's very exciting. For you guys, like, not much is going to change, except we'll sometimes be playing promos for other shows, but, like, that's just a good way to discover new shows to listen to.
Yeah, and also, you know, our podcast will be played on other...
Yeah.
As a... What?
A promo.
I'm not even gonna say it. Include it. Don't even edit that.
Oh, no, I'll leave that in. I'll definitely leave that in. I'd also like to take a moment to thank our newest Patreon members. You're the absolute best. So thank you to Sarah O, Matt S, Adriana V, and Kvetta B. If you'd like to join us, you can do so over at patreon.com/attwgpod. And just as a heads up, starting in January, we will have a few ads on the podcast here or there. Ethan's looking at me because I haven't told him this either, but it's fine. Patreon members, though, will be able to get the episodes early, which they already do, but also ad-free.
Wait, does this mean we have sponsors?
Yeah, we've got a few ads coming up in January. Like, don't get too excited, but it's going to be good. It's going to be good.
Neat.
But enough about us, because who cares? Let's get to Michael Vaughn. Michael Joseph Vaughn was born on June 26, 2016 to Brandy Neal and Tyler Vaughn. Michael is one of four children. He has an older brother and sister, as well as a younger sister. The family lives in Fruitland, Idaho, which is a small town in southwest Idaho. It's about 50 miles from Boise, and Fruitland actually borders Oregon. As of the 2010 census, there are fewer than 5,000 people living in this town. And from what I understand, that number has not grown significantly in the past decade.
So does that mean there's like one stoplight, a McDonald's on one end of the town and a Sheetz on the other?
I would assume so. Or I don't know. Wawa. Maybe it's Wawa. I don't know what they have. Yeah. Or a come and go. I don't know like what's out in Idaho.
What's a come and go?
You know, that's like, it's the same thing. It's like a Sheetz, a Wawa, a come and go.
I have never seen or heard of a come and go.
Yeah. Like a Circle K. Like those are all they're the same basic idea, just regionally different.
Okay.
So I don't know what they have, but yeah, probably something like that. So it really does seem to be like that quintessential small town in the Midwest, you know, that you would see on movies and TV shows. It's the type of place where kids still play outside and everyone knows each other. And that is important to know in terms of the circumstances surrounding Michael's disappearance, because this is also a rural area. Michael and his family, like, they live in a subdivision, but it's surrounded by farmland. As I mentioned, and as you keyed in on, Michael does go by the nickname Monkey in his family, which, you know, is what we call our youngest son, Miller. And, you know, in addition to that and being around the same age, they both have the same interests that all boys seem to have at that age. So they're both into monster trucks, superheroes, cars, and just being like completely insane. His mother describes him as a sweet and energetic boy and says that his laugh is absolutely infectious. It seems as though Michael and his family had a pretty normal life. They went camping, and Brandy's Facebook is filled with photos and videos of her kids just playing in the backyard, eating ice cream, just, you know, typical things that you post on Facebook. And there was nothing really special about July 27th, 2021 either. Brandy had to work that day, and she told the Idaho Press that Michael actually asked her not to go, which isn't something that he usually did. But, you know, she had to. It was a work day. So that evening, as I mentioned, Michael was in the living room playing video games. Now, I'm not sure where his older siblings were or his grandfather, who I think also lives with them. Police haven't really divulged a lot of the actual circumstances around Michael's disappearance, which So when you go into all the online forums, like there's a lot of frustration around that.
But it's way too early in the case.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, at this point, it's still very, very active, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely.
This is not a, they're not at the point where they're seeking public assistance.
Yeah, not really, no. Yeah. And so, and yeah, they are keeping a lot of things close to the vest. So we don't know, you know, like the minute by minute timeline
sure.
leading up to Michael disappearing. So I'm just kind of piecing this together based on, you know, different sources. But I do know that at the very least, Michael, his father, Tyler, and his baby sister, Aria, were home. According to Tyler, between 6:30 and 7 p.m., he went to go check on Aria and order a pizza. When he returned to the living room 15 to 20 minutes later, Michael was gone. Tyler immediately called Brandy at work and said that he couldn't find Michael. So, I mean, I shouldn't say immediately. It's not like he walked into the living room, didn't see Michael, and then picked up the phone. Like, he looked for him.
Right. He looked around the house. He looked in like the backyard.
Like, he wasn't, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, when it was clear that he wasn't just in another room or in the backyard or whatever, like, Tyler called Brandy. So Brandy realized it was serious. She actually left work. She came home. But by the time she got to their house, neighbors were out searching and the police had already arrived. Now, it's getting late at this point, but it's the middle of summer, so it's not dark yet.
Right.
Brandy says that she ran around the neighborhood, you know, knocking on every door, asking if anybody had seen her son. And it turns out that some people had. The Idaho Press article says that neighbors did witness Michael knocking on doors right before his disappearance.
He was outside knocking on doors?
He was outside, yeah. Now, this does kind of seem a little weird, considering that when Michael was last seen, he was wearing a blue Minecraft t-shirt and boxer briefs. So, like, he wasn't dressed to go outside and play. Like, he was dressed to be in his living room playing video games, which is what he was doing.
Right.
So, my first thought when I hear about a kid in his underwear knocking on doors is that he's in distress. But there were some Facebook comments that indicate that that wasn't the case. One neighbor whose door he knocked on said that he just came out and asked if, like, her child could come out and play. I couldn't gather whether or not the kid wasn't there or if the neighbor just told Michael, like, yeah, but go ask your parents first. But either way, like, Michael left and she watched him walk back to his house because she was apparently only a few doors down or around the corner or something like that. And she saw him and she watched him until he got to his front yard. And then she went back inside. Then another neighbor saw him after that running down the block. But that neighbor didn't think it was weird because Michael was heading toward, like, where some other kids were playing. And so he just assumed, you know, he's running over to go play with those kids. And, you know, this is just the kind of neighborhood where, like, you did that. Like, you would see kids running around to go join other kids. That was not a weird thing that would necessarily stick out in anybody's mind. Now, again, this is all based on Facebook comments, not law enforcement statements.
Sure.
But when Michael wasn't found in the immediate area, the entire neighborhood started searching for him. The police even brought canines in immediately. According to Brandy, the dogs caught Michael's scent and tracked it to the end of their street, away from the farm field to the right of the house, but then stopped abruptly. Now, canines certainly aren't infallible. This isn't, like, you know, a science necessarily, but an abrupt stop like that is not really what you want to see in a situation like this.
No, it leads me to believe vehicle abduction.
Right. Yeah.
But as we have discussed on previous episodes, if that were the case, then we're talking about somebody that's been stalking the neighborhood, not necessarily the child.
Now, this investigation was immediately made a top priority. This is 2021. This isn't like 1976, like some of our other cases where they're like, oh, it's a five-year-old. He's probably out on the train tracks making a new life for himself.
Yeah, he's probably, like, fine.
Yeah, no, they knew that this was not great. And this is one of those cases where it really does seem like the responding police department did everything that they possibly could. Because Fruitland is such a small town, So is their police department. They only have 12 officers.
Wow.
Yeah. So police chief J.D. Huff immediately knew that they were in over their heads. And he wasn't afraid to ask for help, which is exactly what you want to see in a situation absolutely. Like this.
Good for him.
Yeah, absolutely. He immediately called in the FBI and neighboring agencies. So like Idaho State Police, you know, people like that. They all came in. And in the days and weeks following Michael's disappearance, they combed farmland, used drones, helicopters, divers, boats, like everything that they could. Because, you know, this is one of those situations where, again, they're surrounded by farmland. And they weren't necessarily thinking abduction at the time. They're thinking like, oh, he like wandered off somewhere, right?
Sure.
But when you're talking about cornfields, like that's kind of hard to search, and that's a lot of space as well. So yeah, they really absolutely. Just brought in everybody immediately because time is not on your side in that situation. But one thing they did not get and could not get was an Amber Alert. In Iowa, you basically need proof that a child has been kidnapped before an Amber Alert is issued.
Yeah, I was just going to ask if that were the case.
Yeah, it's in Iowa, like it's a state
sure.
requirement.
Yeah.
And Fruitland police simply didn't have that.
No, there's no evidence here of an abduction.
No. And you also have to like have that evidence within 12 hours of the child being missing. Like that's the other thing. And, you know, at the beginning, it was just as likely, if not more likely, that Michael had simply wandered off. But Michael's family and their supporters believe that this was a critical mistake that led to the little boy remaining missing now over 4 months later. In fact, I told you at the beginning that Brandy, the family, like everybody is making a huge push for, you know, press and for the case not to go cold right now. They're also all over social media trying to still push for an Amber Alert even now. Now, part of that is because they're trying to get more national attention on this case. And part of it is because the investigation has uncovered some new information in recent months. On October 13th, Fruitland police revealed that they had a few vehicles that they wanted help identifying. So one of the first things that they did, you know, when this whole thing started was ask all of the neighbors for any video surveillance that they had.
Good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I mean, the circumstances around this lead me to believe one of two possibilities, one less likely and one higher likely. The less likely one is that one of the neighbors took him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's less likely because of the close-knit community and the police response.
Mm-hmm.
Higher likelihood, like I said before, is that somebody was casing the neighborhood and wrong time, wrong place was able to snatch up Michael.
Yeah. And so people have been on the internet, of course, you've got like your armchair detectives who, of course, looked up sex offender registries and did find five or six sex offenders nearby who did live there. Two or three of them were convicted for crimes against children. And so people have definitely brought up the neighbor possibility.
And I'm sure that the police looked into that as well.
Yeah, exactly. They definitely did. Back to the video surveillance, you know, this is a neighborhood within a rural area. So there are no nearby businesses or anything that would have had security cameras. So they really had to rely on like Ring doorbell cameras and things like that from the neighbors. That was the only possibility that they had of finding footage. So anyway, so the neighbors, of course, were all very cooperative. They got the footage, they combed through it, and really just looked at every single person, every single vehicle, and just made sure that they were all accounted for. You know, like this person lives in that house, that vehicle belongs to this house. They went through and did all of that, but they were left with two vehicles that they could not identify. A white 2010 to 2016 Honda Pilot was seen on Southwest 8th Street around 6:45 p.m. on July 27th. A blue 2010 or 2011 Dodge Avenger was also seen on Southwest 8th Street before turning onto South Whitley Drive. And again, these are all the streets like right around where Michael was last seen. In addition, there were a few people whom investigators could not identify. One was the man who was jogging on the sidewalk on Southwest 8th Street near Crestview Park around 6:15. This man is described as having dark hair and facial hair. He was wearing dark shorts and no shirt. There was also a second man on Southwest 8th Street. He was wearing a white t-shirt and black shorts and also had dark hair. Now, the vehicles were caught on cameras, and I do have screenshots of those vehicles up on the blog, but it sounds like the sightings of the two men were called in by tipsters. I don't think they were actually caught on camera. Police, of course, aren't saying that any of these men or these vehicles are related to Michael's disappearance. They're just saying, like,
but it's a starting point.
Exactly. They just say, like, listen, they were in the area. We just want to know who they are, what's going on. Because, of course, they have to look into everything. In a press release, they said, quote, "It's very important to understand that these people are not suspects or persons of interest, but it is important to talk to each of them to help us complete the picture of events that took place that evening," end quote. Some people are kind of pointing to these cars as a basis of now doing an Amber Alert, because again, like, for an Amber Alert, you have to have a vehicle, and like, that's typically part of the criteria for getting one.
But there's still no evidence that those vehicles are directly connected.
Exactly. Michael was never actually seen near either of these cars or either of these men, for that matter. They were just in the area at the time that he was last seen. So I don't know if we're really going to get very far in that regard. However, I will say that while they couldn't watch an Amber Alert on July 27th, alerts did go out through Payette County's Code Red system, as well as Idaho's Missing Persons Clearinghouse. Chief J.D. Huff said in a statement, quote, "The first missing and endangered child alert went out at 8:20 p.m. with four different alerts to email, phone calls, and text messages being issued to area residents until 11:20 p.m. that night," end quote. They were working within the parameters that they had, basically. You know, if they could have gotten it, like, they tried to get an Amber Alert. And he said later, he's like, "We requested one, but we couldn't get it." They tried to do what they could do. And so when they couldn't get that, they did these other alerts,
which were more locally focused.
Yeah.
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 Good on them for being proactive and doing what they can. I'm curious as to who controls the Amber Alert system. Is it
state
police?
Yeah, it has to be statewide. Yeah, I don't know if it's state police or what, but like, it's definitely a statewide decision. It's not something that the chief of the Fruitland police.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
It's just...
Yeah, I don't know. And that's one of the things that Brandy is pushing for now, is to change the criteria, because the criteria is different based on state. So Oregon, which again, right over the border, there, the police just have to have a reasonable suspicion that an abduction has taken place.
Well, I'm kind of leaning in that direction here also. Like, what harm is it going to do?
Right.
Like, why do the criteria have to be so restrictive on an Amber Alert? And I know it's the whole boy who cried wolf thing,
right?
But if it's so restrictive, and we know from studying these cases that timeliness is a major factor in a missing and abducted child, do you really need to make the criteria that restrictive around children?
Yeah, no, and I do agree, especially when you have somebody that young. And it's tough, though, because you don't want people to be desensitized to these alerts, which is the fear that if you have too many, because again, 99% of kids who are reported missing are found very quickly. But you're right. But in situations like this, like, you could be wasting precious time. And when you have the technology,
why not use it?
Right. So it's tough. Like, and I understand where kind of both sides are coming from. But yeah, I would tend to err on the side of like what Oregon would say, where, you know, there's a reasonable suspicion of an abduction,
right,
as opposed to like having to actually physically see somebody getting snatched and put into a car or whatever.
Right. I mean, at this point, they had already done searches of fields.
Right. He's five. Like, he couldn't have gotten that far, you know, on his own. Like, had he just wandered off, like, he's not going to be 10 miles away.
Right. And the eyewitness accounts seem to point to him being out and about in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
At that time. And then you have the canine hit that tracks him to a road and then it stops.
Right, right.
I mean, that again, this is not evidence like that you could take to court, but it's reasonable to assume what happened.
And of course, Brandy's like, listen, like he grew up around these like farms. He knows not to just wander off into a cornfield. This isn't his first day here, you know? So yeah, you're right. It's just, it's just a tough, tough situation. Fruitland police have said from the beginning that Michael's family has been cooperating with police, and it doesn't seem as though either of the parents has really been treated as a suspect. Of course, I mean,
I'm sure initially there were questions.
You have to, you have to assume that one or both of the parents had something to do with it. But this is just one of those cases where that does not seem to have been a primary route of investigation. So if you kind of rule that out, then the two options you're left with are stranger abduction, or that he wandered off and got lost in the farmland or a nearby canal. Police continued their extensive searches in the nearby area because statistically, Michael wandering off is a more likely scenario. They reportedly searched the cornfield by his house row by row, but found no trace of the five-year-old. By the end of September, 2 months after Michael's disappearance, the cornfields had been harvested and cleared, and there was no trace of him. This is why, at a press conference on November 19th, Chief Huff said that there was an increased probability that Michael Vaughn was abducted. And he says this basically because they've exhausted all of the other options. They have searched everywhere that he could have reasonably been and turned up absolutely nothing. They've had over 550 tips come in, most of which have been cleared, but some that they are still investigating. They're also still trying to get more information on the vehicles that I mentioned earlier and the men in the area that were seen around the time of Michael's disappearance. The Fruitland community and the Fruitland Police Department have all rallied around Michael's family. Brandy told the Idaho Press that she can barely work and that her other kids have been affected as well. She said her two-year-old daughter, Aria, barely plays with her toys anymore, and her older daughter, Kira, said that she didn't want to have a birthday party this year. But Fruitland police still texted Kira happy birthday, and they bought Aria a gift when she turned two, and they even came to the house and raked a big pile of leaves for Aria to jump in. Of the police, Brandy said, quote, they truly have become family, end quote. And I wanted to make sure I mentioned that because we shit on police departments a lot on this show and they absolutely deserve it. But Chief Huff has been taking this case very personally, as has his entire team. And I do not doubt that this case is something that they think about from the moment they wake up in the morning until the moment they go to bed at night. Now that it's been over 4 months without her son and the holidays are fast approaching, Brandy wants to make sure that everyone knows Michael's story. She said at the press conference in November, quote, he has not been home, and we need every one of you. I need you. I need your help to bring my baby home, end quote. So we want to do our part and tell Michael's story and keep his name out there. Please share this episode. Share the missing posters. Share anything that you see about Michael Vaughn. There are Facebook groups. There are people on Twitter posting about him constantly. And just maybe somebody out there who can help will see it. Anyone with information is urged to contact the Fruitland Police Department at 208-642-6006, extension 0, or contact the department through its tip line at findmichael@fruitland.org. A tip leading to Vaughn's safe return will be awarded with $50,100. This reward is available through March of 2022. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social. And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
Thanks for tuning into this bonus episode, and we'll see you again soon.
See you soon.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Member Week is here at Lowe's. Don't miss your chance to get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, stain, tools, flooring, and more. Shop our exclusive deals happening in-store and online from May 8th through May 14th. Not a member? Join MyLowe's Pro Rewards for free today and get ready to save more. Lowe's, we help you save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.